Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so thrilled to have a brilliant woman on the podcast with me, a woman who is single-handedly changing the way that I personally consume news. Jessica Yellen, the former chief White House correspondent for CNN and the founder of #NewsNotNoise, which offers her fresh perspective on daily news reports via Instagram. She's an Emmy Award-winning political journalist who has worked for MSNBC, ABC News, and CNN. But since this is Second Life, you probably guessed that's not what she's doing right now, and you'd be right. In addition to taking her incredible reporting skills to social media, she's also an author with her first novel, Savage News, coming out on April 9th. She is so fascinating, and I'm just delighted that she's here today. Now, on Second Life, it's Jessica Yellen. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
So on this podcast, we like to start at the beginning.
Okay.
So let's go back and talk about what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So first, thank you for having me on. I'm a big fan and this is fun. I studied women's studies and American history. I was always interested in politics and thought I'd actually be in politics. My parents raised me in a sort of do well, do good mindset. You only succeed if you crush it professionally, but you're also making a difference. And for my family—
Low stakes.
I know, right? Super easy.
No pressure.
No fresh. Good luck. And the most precious thing in our house, the one thing the kids couldn't touch, were these three Life magazines from—this sounds grim, but the JFK assassination— For my dad was JFK's personal page on the floor of the Democratic Convention that year.
No.
And it was life-changing for him. And those values defined him. And he passed that on to me. So for me, studying American history was crucial. And when I started looking into it, I found that all the history department offered were cases of all the wars.
Mm.
American history is a series of wars. And I found that women's studies was a way to bring in the human component.
Got it. Okay. So you thought you would be in politics. Did you think you would be a senator? Did you think you would be president?
You know, I never really had a vision, which is interesting because maybe it was my dad's plan, not mine. Tells you something, right? But, you know, my dad used to say, oh, you should be mayor of Los Angeles or you should be in Congress somehow, you know, something like that. I just knew that being engaged in civic life was important.
Got it. Okay. So you grew up here in LA.
Yeah.
And then you went to school back east at Harvard.
Yes.
So you graduated from Harvard. And then what did you decide to do next?
My first job was as an intern in the Clinton White House, believe it or not.
How did you get that job? What was that like? Tell me everything.
It was crazy. I mean, you graduate from college and, you know, I didn't know what working life was like. And then your first gig is inside the White House. You'd get a hard pass, which is what you swipe to go through security, and you walk into the White House every day. First, I was—
So you're like 22 and at the White House.
As an intern, so you're super junior and very nervous and unsure, right? You don't know what to make of anything.
Had you interned before?
Well, I mean, I'd worked summers, so I assumed it meant Xeroxing. In high school, that's what I learned the interns did back then. In this gig, it was very different. At the White House, my first job as an intern was working in the healthcare war room. And I effectively acted as a journalist, to be honest.
Really?
So, yeah, I was assigned in the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, which is the outreach of the White House to local elected officials, mayors, local members of the legislature, and governors. And those are very important relationships because it's your connection to the states. It's especially true when the president's a former governor. And my job was to kind of find out if the president's going to a town, what are their local healthcare needs? What are their issues? And how does our healthcare legislation address that?
How would you find that out?
I would just make a lot of phone calls.
So old school reporting.
I was reporting, yeah.
Wow. I was going to say, because like, did the internet, was it helpful at that point?
No. What internet? Oh, my God. I mean, we were basically barely emailing. That's an overstatement. We emailed, but no. There was no really, let's Google this.
Wow.
It was phone calls, you know, look at newspapers. Super old school.
That's so crazy. Okay, so you would call, you would find out what the healthcare needs. You would put together a briefing for the president and his team. That's an incredible, incredible training ground.
It was great training to be a journalist. I don't know how effective I was as a White House staffer. I just, you know, I got this information. I passed it on. You never knew what happened to it. It all the paper flows to a central place, the White House staff secretary, and you never know what makes it in or doesn't.
Wow. Okay. So what did you do next?
So at the White House, I kept observing that, first of all, I was always interested in the media. I came from LA. You cannot help but be interested in Hollywood and culture when you grow up here. And then I had this political interest, right? So, I mean, the obvious way to bring them together is in the news, right? Politics and media. When I was working in the White House, in those days, there was only one 24-hour channel, that was CNN. And every room had this big, I mean, I don't know how old your listeners are, but if the older ones will recall, our TVs back then were these huge boxes, right?
Right. No flat screens, guys.
No plasmas. No. And it would, there was this massive box TV that would hang in the corner of every room in the West Wing. I remember ours was hung on fish wire, basically. And there are two things that could stop the room, make everyone go silent. The president walking in or that TV with CNN on reporting on the White House. And whenever they'd come on talking about the White House, people would go silent. And I appreciated then the power of those reporters and what they were saying. And I often thought, oh, my gosh, I wish they were covering what I'm working on now. I wish they were covering this or that differently. And I kept thinking, well, I want to do that. And I want to be able to cover the stories that I think are important.
Interesting. So what was your leap then?
So I left the White House and I had to
How long had you been at the White House?
I was there for, I think it was almost 2 years, as I recall it, maybe 18 months. I had a couple different jobs in intergovernmental affairs. And then I decided that the thing to do was to try journalism.
Did you have – so I went to USC, mm-hmm. and there's a huge broadcast journalism department there. And I remember seeing girlfriends of mine, and they were working on their tape.
Yeah.
And you know, like they would come in full hair and makeup.
Right.
And, you know, it was such a very specific look and a very specific vibe.
You can say that again.
And they were very hungry, and it was very cutthroat. It was known as being one of the most difficult departments and most competitive departments at USC. So just having a light bit of exposure to aspiring broadcast journalists, I'm curious, like, did you have a tape? Did you have a sense of what it would be like to be on camera? Was that the goal? Did you want to work behind the scenes in producing? What was your dream?
So, excellent questions. I wanted to cover the White House, and I wanted to have a voice. That's what mattered to me. I wanted to have a voice. And I initially thought that I would be in print. I came home. I worked for Los Angeles Magazine. I got a job editing there. And I started talking to people about how do you get to the White House? How do you do White House reporting? And in those days, everyone said to me, print is dead. TV is the future, which was not true, by the way. You know, the media is going through convulsions, but print reporters are still hugely influential and vital. But, you know, you get advice at certain points in your life and it can shape your life. So I decided that to stay alive in this career, I had to be in TV. I didn't aspire to be a TV reporter necessarily, but I thought that was the future. So I did exactly what you're saying. I went out. I was told you have to make a tape.
Mm-hmm.
No idea what that meant. Basically reported out what that meant, just called a lot of people. What does a tape look like? And then I went to, I can't remember if it was like Nordstrom's back, you know, then, and just bought the most colorful suits I could find because that's how TV reporters look, right?
Still.
I know, that's true. And I just bought a bunch of suits, made my hair look shellacked, and went out, hired a cameraman, and went out and reported some stories for the tape.
So were they stories that you just found in yeah. your own head for news? Do you remember what any of them were about?
I did one. This is a good question. I did one that was about leaf blowers that the city council in Los Angeles was, I think, passing legislation to ban leaf blowers or regulate when they can make their noise. And then I interviewed a member of the city council who I found, you know, as a local news story. And then I stood outside of a hospital and I did a live shot. You know, someone's just been rushed to the hospital behind me. I think back on that. If I could find that, it would be a comedy.
I would love to see it. So you put together your tape. Did you edit it yourself? Did you
No, I hired someone because I had no idea.
And then what did you do with it?
So then, again, I got advice from other people and they said you have to send it. You buy this book that lists, you know, no Google then. It lists all the news channels and local news in, like, you know, Palm Springs, Fresno, Chico. And I just made copies of the tapes and sent them to all the news channels. And then you call and call and call and follow up with them.
So did you stick to just California?
I did West Coast, places I could drive to.
Okay.
And I got calls back from Palm Springs, Fresno, Chico, Las Vegas. That's what I remember.
That's pretty great.
I mean, so then – or replies, I should say, engagement.
Something.
But then I went to one station and they made me wait in the waiting room for 3 hours until they finally were like, we're not meeting with you.
Well, that's very respectful of your time.
Yeah. I went to another station when they brought me in and they said, I'm not going to actually watch your tape because blondes make stupid tapes, but I'm looking for an assistant. Do you want to be my assistant? And I was like, do you have an opportunity to report if it's a way in? And they're like, no. I just want you answering my phone. I was like, okay.
My jaw is on the floor right now.
It's, you know, it's like part of this is paying your dues. You have to bang your head against a wall for a long time. The hardest one or most memorable was a news director who really was, you know, I'd love to put you on air. I think you're very bright. I think you have potential. Then he leans back, puts his feet on the desk and says, but I'm the only man in town to date. Would that be a problem?
No.
So I remember that so clearly. And I said
ew, casting couch for the news. That's totally horrible. Ew.
This was the 90s, you know. So I said to him, I'm really good at making friends. I'm sure I'll be okay.
No callback?
No callback. Yeah. Yeah.
So what happened next?
I went back home. I got an offer from Chico. I went back home, I think, and I was in the hair. I went, what does a girl do when she's bummed out? I went to the hair salon, and my hairdresser said, oh, you got to meet my next client. Stay to meet my next client. He's a local reporter, an anchor, and he'll give you advice. And I was like, you know what? I've talked to so many other reporters. They're so discouraging. I don't have the wherewithal right now to hear more negativity. And they're like, I'm telling you, he's different. The guy comes in. His name is Robert Kovacic. He is an anchor in local news. And he said to me, honey, nobody understood me either. You have to find the right news director. Here's my information. Send me a tape. I have an idea. Amazing person. Total pay it forward human. I've paid it forward on his behalf for so long. I think it took me like a month to get up the courage or where to send him a tape. I sent him the tape. And he had a former news director who had moved to Orlando, Florida, to launch a local 24-hour channel for the middle of Florida. And I connected with them. They got the tape. And they said, if you are willing to move to Orlando and be a one-man band reporter, meaning you get the camera, you shoot, edit, write, produce everything, you got a job.
And at that point, you knew how to report, but
that's it.
And to produce, essentially, which is really just ideation, but to edit and to do camera work and to be on camera are all newer skills, I'm guessing.
Beyond. I mean, I was so green and not ready for that job. They really took a risk on me. And I took a risk, too, moving there. I remember my first day, they teach you how to use the camera, and all they focus on is what they call white balancing, so that the film doesn't look blue or green. How do you make the colors look right? So I got it locked in my head. The most important thing is to white balance. So when I went out the next day, all I cared about was the white balance, and I didn't think about anything else. And when you have to do your stand-up, your reporter stand-up, you hit record, run in front of the camera, do your stand-up a couple times, and then go home with it, right? That's what I thought you do. I didn't know to check. I didn't think to, like, rewind and check how the video looked before I go home. But I'm obsessed with white balancing, so I get back, and the video all up to my stand-up looks great. It's so white balanced. The colors are all correct. And then you get to the part where I'm doing the reporter stand-up, and all it is, I didn't think to check, so I zoomed super close, and the shot is only of my chest, like my boobs, and the mic flag in front of my boobs. I mean, it's like you could have, if you wrote it for a sitcom, people would be like, that's over the top.
Too on the nose.
And of course, everybody in the bureau is crowded into my booth to watch my video because it was the new girl's first day and they want to be supportive. Oh, it was special.
That's amazing. So how did it go from there?
They were like, we can't use that video. We'll work on your framing. Why don't you just voice over that part?
Great. Yeah. Right.
So I voiced over it. And then the follow-up to that is the next day I go out and I'm so conscious of making it a wide shot that I made it so wide all you could see were trees. You couldn't even see the person. I ran to one side of a field and put the camera at the other side of the field. And I was like, I blended it to the trees.
Oh, that's amazing. So how long were you in that job and what were some of the most important skills that you learned while doing it?
That was a great job because it was really just, here's an assignment, figure everything out.
Just thrown in the deep end.
Thrown in the deep end. And Orlando was a town where I didn't know anyone and I didn't know anyone who knew anyone. So I had no connections. And I just would get an assignment. It was before you had Waze or GPS. So I got a map. First, you have to figure out who you're interviewing. And then you have to figure out on the map how to get there. And then I would alone interview them, tape my stand-up, get the pickup shots, and then drive back to the bureau. And then you have to write it and edit it before the news.
That's a really fast turnaround.
Yeah.
And what sort of assignments were you getting? Did you have a specific beat? Was it all-purpose?
At that point, I was general assignment to begin with. And I did everything from, it's hurricane season, we got to trim the trees. Here's what their tips for, you know, when you trim to, you know, hurricane prep. Sometimes we did, there's a ton of violent crime. We would always cover crime stories. You know, you're near NASA, you're near or Disney, there's, you know, tourism, there's the freeze is coming for the trees that's an orange, you know, Florida grows oranges. Those were big stories. But I always had this interest in politics. So whenever I could, I'd pitch, can I do a profile on the mayor? Can I do a profile on who's running for whatever?
Okay, so you were getting assignments and then also being proactive in pitching.
Yes, you have to.
So skills that you were learning.
First, I was learning to solve things. One of the most valuable things is having the experience of shooting and editing helped me think of stories visually. And so because I always knew, gosh, if I'm telling this, how am I going to cover that those words with video? For the rest of my career, I've thought of my stories that way and helps me work really well with cameramen and women because I'm always thinking of their piece of it. I mean, the best part of that job is, especially when you're in local news, people who are strangers open their door, invite you into their home, and tell you their life story. And I found that to be precious and important and exciting. In a way, some of those stories have meant more to me than even interviewing presidents, you know, because—
Which we're going to get to.
But it's so intimate, and there's such vulnerability, and they're trusting you with these stories. And you also see people's lives. It gives you a window into America.
So what did you dislike about that job?
Oh, it was super hard. I don't like isolation. So when I got to the next station, I had a camera person I'd work with. And that to me was game changing because, first of all, they are the most exceptional humans. Like, these are people who see, right? Their job is to see life. And so they're empathic and engaged and caring. And also, if you're a local news camera person, you've done every story there is 10 times. So you already know the drill, and they help me shortcut things. Like, you don't need to get that video. You're never going to use it. You don't need to ask that question. You're never going to use it. The advantage of someone else's experience was amazing. So the hardest part was just being on my own and making my mistakes without having a sounding board to kind of help say no or talk through things. That was challenging for me.
Working in a vacuum mm-hmm. is difficult. I've always felt that that's the lucky thing about being a journalist is having an editor, having someone else who you're talking the ideas through, because I mean, there's something really amazing about having that solo responsibility, but it also sometimes can be – I mean, as you said, it's isolating. So broadcast journalism, you tend to move from city to city as you get bigger and bigger. And how did you know when it was time to look for the next job, and how did you start to hone in on politics as your beat and get your bosses to allow you to focus on that?
So I always knew my goal was to be White House correspondent. So at every job interview, I would say that, which was very funny when you're interviewing for local news in Orlando and Tampa. And they're like, okay, well, here's what you're going to be doing here. But I also said when there's an opportunity, I would love to cover politics. And I
set your intentions up front. Yeah. I think that's smart.
And so I got a chance to cover politics. My next stop was Tampa, which is a very big market. And I said to them, I'd love to cover politics. And they let me. And I happened to be covering the Senate race that year, in the year 2000. In Tallahassee, and I was in Tallahassee, Florida, the night of the presidential election. And they called it for Gore, and then they called it for Bush, and then we didn't know. And my bosses paged me at that point, because we had pagers, and said, get to the Secretary of State's office. And I was at the Secretary of State's office the year 2000 during the recount at 5 a.m., and I covered it for 35 days with all the big dogs from all the networks arriving. I was in reporter heaven.
What was that like, too? So, I mean, this is your neck of the woods, and then at this point, and then you're seeing people come in from D.C. and from New York and L.A.
Honestly, it was crazy. It was like, you know, I'm from L.A., so I see it was like a movie. I kept thinking it was like time-lapse photography. One second, I'm just in this room with my local news reporters I know, and then there goes Linda Douglas, and then here's Cokie Roberts. And then all these people that were famous and heroes to me from national news are showing up where I am. It was exceptional. And then the other piece of it is I understood what was going on, and I was – I don't want to sound arrogant, but I was really good at the story. I understood the story. I owned it. And it was very empowering for me to be able to cover this story with confidence next to these network anchors. And that gave me a sense that, you know what, I can do this. I can definitely do this.
So what'd you do next?
So we covered that, and then I had another year on my contract, and as soon as it was appropriate, I got an agent, and I had an agent at the point, but he started pitching me to the Nationals. And
isn't that really soon? That seems early, yes?
I mean, look, there are people who write for CNN.com, and then one day they're put on air, and then they're covering national stuff. So the truth is there's no set path.
And there's not like a very specific ladder or hierarchy.
There's a traditional ladder, but it doesn't apply anymore. And I was at the early end of seeing that it doesn't apply.
Got it. So you had been a broadcast reporter for less than 3 years, and you start pitching yourself to national network news.
Yes. So I had an agent who had a client who just gotten an anchor job at MSNBC, and he knew they were looking for an overnight anchor. And the overnight anchor was somebody who would have to come in at like 10 at night and would do news updates every half hour. So here's what's happening at, you know, in this hour, blah, 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 for, you know, whatever it was, 2 minutes. And you stay up all night doing that every
so,
half
like,
hour.
The graveyard shift.
It was the graveyard shift. But your purpose there is to be live covering breaking news when it happens. And they needed somebody who could ad lib. And because I'd worked at Central Florida News 13 in Orlando, where we had to ad lib endlessly on the morning on the news, because I became an anchor there eventually, I had that skill. And so
how do you have that skill? What is that about? How do you develop that?
You literally try and fail and try until you get it right. Like when you're live on a breaking story in that kind of context, it's not scripted. But what happens is somebody comes in your ear and gives you a new piece of information. And then they come in your ear and bring in an interview. And so what you can do is now after the interview, you listen carefully to what they're saying and you incorporate their information into your next ad lib, right? And every person that comes on adds to the information you have that you can just keep recycling.
I'd just like to point out that as someone who has had an in-ear piece once when I had to do – I was doing like a live selling broadcast thing for the internet for this company called Style Mint with Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen. And they are talking in your ear and you're talking to people and talking in general. And then there's also a camera and the teleprompter. Yeah. It is an insane amount to balance. It's like – walking and chewing gum and throwing fiery like batons in the air and then also hopping on one leg. How did you keep all of that straight?
It can get – I love your story. That's a perfect summation of it. It can get really, really mind scrambling. Like you can feel like you have scrambled eggs brains. But when you find a good producer, a control room producer, it's like ballroom dancing with an expert. And the trick is for them to say just enough but not have a conversation with you. And they're supposed to come in when you're pausing. So it's like in between your breath, they'll be like, video rain. And so you're like, we now have video of the rain coming down in Haiti right now. It is, as we've said, it's going to be a devastating hurricane, but this is just the tip of it. And they'll say, Admiral coming in three. And we're going to have an interview coming up soon with an admiral who has, you know, helped with the devastation cleanup in an environment like this. That's coming up. So it's all about them.
Tiny words like that's such a – it's like you're speaking in code.
Yes. But it's like they see where you're headed. They drop in some information and you incorporate it.
That's incredible. So you started doing this.
I started doing it. I had to audition by – doing a breaking news event where we're talking about breaking news and then the teleprompter crashes and then somebody comes in your ear and starts telling you what the news is. And so the audition was, can you function in the environment you've just described? So I ended up working the overnights. I'd live in New York City and drive out to MSNBC at the middle, you know, in the night.
Where is MSNBC?
At that point, it was in Secaucus, New Jersey. It's not anymore, but it was then. You go in makeup. They're amazing. They get you in – the makeup room is always the place where, like, they boost your confidence. You feel good, right? And then
– you had your bright suits.
So. Yes, exactly. Oh, my gosh.
So you're in the makeup room. Yeah. They boost your confidence. And then you go out and you are on from 10 until what time?
I think as I recall, it was either 6 a.m. or depending on the day, 7 a.m. Only on the half hour unless there's breaking news.
I mean, that also has got to be such an intense, you know, like your energy has to be all over the place.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's very hard for your lifestyle, you know, because you're sleeping during the day and working at night and working with very, you know, a small graveyard shift set of people.
How long did you do that?
1 year.
And what was the best thing you learned?
How to function inside a network, you know, how to handle national stories in the same way with confidence.
Got it. And then at some point, you moved past that.
Yeah.
How did you move to CNN?
So I went from there to ABC News. At ABC, I covered a lot of – I did the overnights on the weekends, and I covered stories for Good Morning America. And the stories they wanted were like a lot of tabloid stories. You know, Martha Stewart's going to jail. Jason Williams, a basketball player, shot his driver. There's a trial. Michael Jackson trial. And at every turn, I would tell management, I really want to be White House correspondent. And they'd be like, that's great. Go cover Martha Stewart. But I always said it. So one day, the White House correspondent for Good Morning America got a promotion, Kate Snow. And they had an opening all of a sudden they needed to fill. And so I got this call and they were like, Jessica, don't get excited. I was like, okay. And they said, we have an opening at the White House for 2 weeks. We'd like you to fill in for 2 weeks. This is not your job. And I was, can you get to DC? I was like, no problem. So I covered the White House for 2 weeks and then it became a month and then it became 2 months and then it became 5 months. And finally, they're like, fine, you can stay. So that's how I got to the White House. And it was because I consistently said what I wanted. And then when I had the opportunity, I just dove in. And I didn't bother with, you know, what does this mean? What's the title? Blah, blah. And then I was doing that. I was covering the Bush White House for ABC. And you were constantly in the White House press corps with other reporters. And I saw that the CNN reporters had like more opportunity to tell the news, right? Because they're on all the time. And so sometimes they would do the silly stories, but sometimes they'd also do the substance stories. I saw that there was more breadth. And I decided I'd try to do that.
And so what did you do next?
So I got a job at CNN, but it wasn't covering the White House. I was covering Capitol Hill, which was an amazing experience because you have to know Congress in order to cover Washington effectively. And I also got to work with Dana Bash, who is crushes it as a reporter, knows more about politics than most politicians. And that was just great. And while I was at covering Congress, it was about to be the election. It was 2007. And management said to me, listen, we want to give you a taste of the presidential. You're brand new here, so you're not going to get to be on the whole campaign. And, you know, our more seasoned reporters are going to be on the big candidates, Hillary and McCain and Romney. But we're going to give you this new guy named Barack Obama, who probably basically – they didn't say this, but everybody assumed it'd be a short-lived thing, right? Because he's new and I was new, whatever. So in Iowa, I got there, I can't remember, end of November 2007 or beginning of December, and interviewed him when he was a senator, right, on our Election Express bus, and then covered him through Iowa and, you know – the rest is history.
That's incredible. What is it like sitting down with a president? And you, because you've interviewed multiple presidents.
So it kind of depends. They're human beings. So it sort of depends how well you know them, what's the context. But it's always – I've always found that to be sort of exhilarating in that way that you lock into your zone. There are other times where I feel like I've not asked the right questions or I've missed the mark. But when you're interviewing a president, you just kind of like hone in and your brain works, right? And so you just engage. And I've, you know, seen the presidents in different settings. And when you do cover them, you get to – it's not like you're boys. You know, you're not hanging. But they know you. You know them.
There's a rapport.
Yeah.
What is the least expected thing about interviewing a president?
Oh, that's such a good question. It's the off-camera stuff where they make chit-chat with you or you see, you know, the kinds of questions they ask. One of the things I never imagined is – it seems obvious in retrospect, but when you're interviewing a president, I found all of a sudden the room fills up. It seems like there are 25 people standing behind the president, and I'm not talking security, you know. Like, you're just – you're not alone. The two of you are on camera, and there's a sea of people who are watching. And for me, that is weirder than talking to a president because he's a human. You can relate to him. You can connect and vibe off him. But you feel all these other people like judging and evaluating and measuring and sensing. And
it's just energy.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. So back to your career. So things are going swimmingly. Mm-hmm. You are rising up the ladder so quickly. At what point did you start to feel like, I don't know about this anymore?
So, you know, all along, my goal was to tell certain kind of stories. Going back to the White House, I was saying, gosh, I see those people on TV. Sometimes they're doing the silly stuff. I wish they'd do more substantive stuff. If I'm there, I'll do that. And I always had this idea in my head that as I got more senior, I would be able to drive a little bit more and decide what kind of stories I tell and how. And I had this instinct the whole time that there are certain ways we were leaving a lot of the audience out of the conversation by not explaining our terms, by not sort of setting up, this is a story that matters, here's why. And then also with the way we covered it, by making everything sports, right? This one's winning, this one's losing. Oh, this is so outrageous, let's scream. And I thought when I was out in the field, I was talking to people who were asking the questions that validated what I thought, right? People weren't asking me like, you know, why did this candidate say this thing? They're asking me, does Iran have a bomb or not? How will the tax plan affect me, right? They want some concrete info. I felt we weren't doing the greatest job at giving. And so I was kind of banging my head against a wall in some ways because I was pitching stuff that didn't match the kind of environment. And so it was true for a long time. It was when I finally went back to the White House again, very senior, that I kind of realized, like, I've done this before. I'm here again. And I'm not doing it the way I want to do it.
You're still pinned in some ways.
It wasn't their business model, right? Their business model is we get eyeballs by telling stories in a certain way.
Win, loss, yell.
Right. It was always true. It's more true now. I have a theory that this is actually very problematic now because we're already in such a triggered state. Everything's so high emotion already that telling the news that way actually sends people over the edge sometimes. But going back to where I was then, I just felt like there's something I really want to do. In my gut, I believe that this has to exist. And I realized, like, I doesn't work here. It just isn't going to work here. They don't want it. I don't – it does not a match. And so I have to make a different choice. The problem is you're, you know, on TV, White House correspondent. It looks like the most successful job, right? It looks amazing.
So, you had achieved the goal.
Right. And then what do you do? Do you walk away? How do you do that?
What did you do?
I walked away.
So we talk about money on this podcast a lot because I think that it's really important to talk to women especially about that piece of it. Was – did you have like a nest egg? Had you saved over the years? How did you reconcile leaving this amazing job with like the financial reality of not necessarily having a huge plan for what was next?
It's a really important question. And what I did was I saved. I'm very conservative with finances. I mean, to the point that my friends listening to this will laugh. And I just always saved money. And the advice I'd give young women is basically, you don't know why you're saving it, but when you have the opportunity to save, do it because it will empower you later. It gives you
options.
Options. And, you know, I couldn't go move to a desert island and live the rest of my life large, but I had the flexibility to be able to make a different choice.
Got it. So you decide to make a leap. What did you do next?
Well, first I escaped. Like I went to Bali. First I just needed a break.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had been in the rat race. I mean, that is a like a relentless news and work cycle.
It's really – I mean, the news cycle drives you. And, you know, you do a series of presidential campaigns. It's nonstop.
Always on.
Always on. It's exhilarating. It's important. I mean, I have so much respect for my colleagues who are on the trail every day now on the case.
But it's exhausting.
It's exhausting. And for me, I needed to make a change. And I was so tired at that point. I remember my brother saying, I was obsessing over something. I can't remember what. My brother's like, it doesn't matter. You need to go away. I don't care what it is. You need to be on vacation 1 week from today. Solve it. And I had during the presidential campaign, I used to do what I called, it was like travel porn. So you'd be staying in some Lord knows where motel, right? And I would at night before I go to bed just look at spas around the world, you know, to escape. And it was my escape. And there was this one spa I always came back to, weirdly, online. Nobody told me about it. I just found it. And I decided to go there. I got there and after a day I called the front desk and said, you know what, this isn't working for me. I'm gonna leave. I was like in this manic place, right?
Still wound.
Yeah. Maybe it was after 2 days. And then I went to sleep that night, and I think I woke up 24 hours later. It was crazy.
Wow.
And then I ended up staying. I wish I'd stayed longer, but I stayed for like two and a half weeks. I went to Bali in Japan. So I really took time off.
That's important. So at what point did you start thinking about news, not noise?
So I always had in my head that, as I was saying, that there's this need for news told differently. But I also really, really, really always wanted to write a novel. I mean, that was like what drove me. So I decided first I was going to do that. I just wasn't ready to do the other thing. And so I sat down and what I wanted to do was sort of tell the story of what it's like to be on the inside. Some of what we've talked about, but also the pressure to like break the news and get it right and be on, but also your hair has to look a certain way.
It's so exterior and interior at the same time.
And there's a real tension there. Like I tell this story in the book about she's at the White House and her boss calls her in and is like, your hair appeared to be an eighth of an inch longer on one side than on the other.
Is that a true story?
That's a true story.
You're kidding me.
No.
That's so intense. So tell us about the novel.
Okay, so the book is about a young White House a young woman who's always wanted to cover the White House, and she gets a chance at the job just as the First Lady vanishes, and so she's assigned to cover the case of the missing First Lady, which appears to be a sex scandal. But as she's on the salacious story, she realizes there's a much more important story going on, and the fundamental tension is they literally set her up in a competition with a man for the job. and he gets the more substantive angle on the story. So how do you break, how do you differentiate, how do you break through, how do you do the story with integrity when you're up against these challenges?
So you started working on the novel, which is called Savage News.
Thank you.
Immediately after leaving?
Yeah. And I was very bad at it. It turns out writing a novel is very hard.
So it's so hard.
And there's like a thing. It's like any – I don't know why I was so crazy. I was like, I'm going to sit down. It's just going to flow out and it's going to be no problem.
Yeah. What's your process like?
I just kind of would write when I had the time. I'd write every day when I had the time. And what I came to realize is I eventually paired up with an editor I found. And we would talk about what should be in the next chapter. And then I would write that. And then we'd talk about...
So you didn't have an outline. You didn't know where your characters were going.
I did. I did have all that, but it was still like, how do you block and tackle within? And I didn't have the tools to know these are the bag of tricks, right? So you have to, like, this is the thing. You can't rely on yourself for everything. You have to ask people who have expertise for help.
Can't just be in the vacuum.
Right. And that's been a challenge. Like, that's been a learning for me always. I mean, the whole novel thing was like, it's incredibly challenging. And there were points where I felt like I'd swum out to the middle of the ocean and didn't know if I should just give up or keep going, right? But I always wanted to tell this story. And I also wanted to tell a story of just a woman in the workplace and some of the pressures and challenges that, whether it's Me Too or judgment for being ambitious and woman.
Oh, I love what you said, working while female.
That's it.
Which is a liability in so many ways and an asset. So you're working on the book. Uh-huh. How long did it take to write the book?
The book took, I mean, it depends how you measure my start, 2 or 3 years. I'm not kidding.
And during this time, you started doing News Not Noise.
I started in the back of my head thinking about how, what is the need? How does, I know there's this thing where we need to do the news differently. But what does that look like? How do you actually do that in the world? I'm not a network. And then I just talked to a lot of people who, to be honest, were mostly very discouraging, who are saying, you know, it's a really challenging time in the media landscape. It's hard to win audience.
Were you thinking about like having a YouTube channel? Were you thinking it would always be something that lived on Instagram? Were you thinking it was a Facebook story? What was your plan?
Originally, I mean—
Did you want to start your own network?
I mean, I wanted to start my own network. I wanted to—I mean, ideally, like, I didn't need it to be me. Like, still, I always think that it needs to be a group of people who are badass journalists who want to approach things differently. And that means tell the human side of the story, focus on some of the stories that are being ignored, and tell with calm and a focus on the most important thing being the viewer leaving with a sense of understanding. I don't need you to think I have the best sources. I don't need you to think I got the story first. I don't need the exclusive. I know these are things you're never supposed to say. I need to know that when you're done, you understand the story better and that you feel confident to talk about it and eventually empowered to act on it. Now, that's like anathema in the news. Everything I even felt weird saying I don't need to get the story first right now, because that's like saying I don't want to be a killer, like a successful reporter.
I don't want to win.
I don't want to win. And so what the idea is, how do you change what winning means? Mm-hmm. Because my true belief is I don't know that the audience is obsessed with the fact that I broke this 5 minutes before someone else. I think that they want someone they trust who tells them in a way they relate to and makes it seem important to their life and doesn't waste their time.
I also think that with social media, there's no exclusive anymore. So when we publish an exclusive story on Who, What, Where, it's exclusive until we hit publish. Then it's out in the world and anyone can pick it up and report on it. So it now belongs to everyone. We're the source material, but the story belongs to everyone now. Which is different.
But the challenge is gatekeepers don't see it that way. Like, mm-hmm. if you try to go to a network and pitch something, or if you go to like a podcast, you know, it's still the mindset, what can you get that no one else can? And my reorientation is, how can we connect in a way that no one else can, or that's unique for our audience and brings more people to a sense of confidence and understanding?
So explain News Not Noise to our listeners, if for those who don't know it, although you should, and you should definitely follow her.
Aw, thank you. So I had this idea. We should tell the news differently. I pitched it all over the place and people did not get it. I was told things like, oh, no, the reason the news is told the way it is because that's the only way people will consume it. That's what they want. And I was like, people don't want shouting panels of pundits. Some do, but there's a huge group that doesn't. And so I both got unsure and also wanted to challenge myself. Like, if I want to do this, I need to know that I actually have the muscles to tell a story differently. Like, my training is the minute a story breaks, I still have that instant reaction where I'm like, where's the – who do I call? Where's – you know, I
so, – muscle memory.
Muscle memory. So can I do the news differently? And while I was writing the novel, a few people showed up in my life who were like, just do it. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, go on Facebook and start a newscast every day just talking to an audience. Go on YouTube. Just do it.
Proof of concept.
And they were like, you'll start doing it and you'll see what it becomes. And I really couldn't make myself do it. I mean, I'm writing the book. I was also working on, you know, restoring balance, thinking about life differently, all those things. And I just finally got to this place where two more people showed up and then called me up every day and were like, do it, do it, do it. It's really hard to, you know, one time be the chief White House correspondent on the North Lawn with a cameraman and a sound guy.
And a network behind you.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden you're like, I'm some person in my house talking to my phone, right? That's a challenge. But it turns out it was the challenge like day one and day two. And the minute I put it out there the first time, I mean, P.S., a comedy, the first one.
But and it's also, I mean, getting out of the way of your own ego is
huge.
The big, big work.
That is so true. Yeah, that's true. And I think this whole thing has been personal growth for me and also just so rewarding because I now have this sense of connection with an audience that I know is benefiting. So what I did is I just decided to leap and I did an Instagram story.
On your own personal Instagram.
On my own personal Instagram. And I got feedback from like the few people who watched, right? And for me at that time, I didn't think I'd get an audience. Again, it was really – I had this idea about how the news has to change. I wanted to pitch it, and I wanted to have done it differently to say this is what it should be. And I didn't know what those things were. Like I say to you now, it needs to be calm. It needs to – we need to explain our terms. I want to leave you a sense of understanding. I didn't get to that until doing the stories. And
– sometimes you just have to do the work.
It's the work.
But it grew really quickly.
Well, so what I found is there's some serious sisters out there. So I started doing the stories and both – I'd met Amy Schumer at an event and I'd met Jessica Seinfeld socially and they started following me and then they started reposting and telling other people to watch. And then their people started telling people to watch. And then that just grew and grew and grew and it was – all word of mouth. For me, that was just so, I don't know what to say except heartwarming. Like, I put this thing out there that I believed in and it got that kind of response.
I mean, it's authenticity and it's also proving your vision. That's an incredible feeling.
It was amazing.
I mean, I was trying to explain to someone the other day that the places I get my news are the New York Times website, plus the Weekend Edition, a handful of podcasts, and from Instagram, from your Instagram.
Oh, my God. I'm so flattered. Thank you.
I'm not going to lie. Someone, they looked at me. They're like, you get your news from Instagram?
Right.
Like, of
What's
course,
wrong with
blonde,
you?
Ridiculous human. And I was like, no. It's like, Jessica, she's amazing. These are her chops. I just feel like politics and the world at large, news at large, is so overwhelming. I just want someone to break down what's actually important, draw some of those connections, and help me understand. And that's what News Not Noise does for me. So I think it's you've hit on something really powerful and really incredible.
Thank you. Thank you. That's amazing.
I love it.
My general philosophy is there's just too much information coming at everyone all the time. And it's if you're not steeped in it, it's very hard to distill what really matters from what's just chatter and a drama that'll pass. And that's the skill I've honed over two decades in the news business. Like, I know this is a story. I know that's not. And I know how to tell it. And so it's not just those things I should say. It's also saying, here's the noise. You can pay attention to it if you want. It's like Us Magazine.
It's
fun.
It's a thing.
But it doesn't matter. It's not going to change anybody's life. Here's the stuff that really matters. Here's what it means.
So we have a handful of questions we always ask on this pod, one of which is the biggest mistake you've made in your career and what you've learned from it.
So the biggest mistake is always been not trusting my gut. And that goes for stories, like where you think the story is in this direction, but everybody's pushing you in a different, or it goes for making choices in your career and what advice you take, right? I've always believed that you have to, you know, it was from my dad. He was like, he used to say, follow your bliss and follow your truth. Those are two different things sometimes.
Quite.
But be true to yourself, basically. And so how do you find that in every moment? How do you take the time to find what's true for yourself?
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are interested in changing lanes in their career and doing something different, but they might be a little afraid of making that leap. What advice would you give someone who wants to follow their truth and or follow their bliss, right, but hasn't quite got it together enough to actually do it?
So there are certain things you need to have. You need to have the savings. You need to know what you want. That's key. But then you have to just get past the fear. So much of the hard—
How do you do that?
So, okay, I worked with this woman at CNN named Gloria Borger, who's an amazing human, like a mentor to other women, a kind human, an amazing reporter. And when I was thinking of leaving, she would always say, leap and the net will appear. And that was so counter to everything I was about, which was like having a path, knowing what you are going to do, you know, executing on a plan. And this was sort of like trusting in yourself. You know, you could say trusting in the universe, yes, but also trusting yourself. And you only can get past the fear by stepping off the diving board.
I love that. So my last question is also my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with younger Jessica, what advice would you give her?
It's a version of what I just said, which is basically, if you're not sure, just you need to take some time and find, connect, reconnect with yourself. Make sure that you're connecting with yourself and figure out what your truth is. Because without exception, every time I've been very clear about what it is that I want and I believe is right, as long as you articulate that, it's very important. Don't just assume people know. You know what you want. You have to tell people, speak up for yourself, and then do the work. But get clear on what's true for you and stick with your gut.
I love that. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was former chief White House correspondent and current founder of hashtag News Not Noise and author of Savage News, Jessica Yellen. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. It actually makes a huge difference. We love seeing you spread the word about the show on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram and Twitter. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show. So if you have a great idea, send in your requests via email to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, and the show is at Second Life Pod. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.